One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Hey, everybody. We've got a great one today, you know, for a change. Paul Krugman is my guest, the New York Times columnist, Nobel Prize winning economist. I won a few Emmys. He's also a best-selling author, and his latest is Arguing with Zombies, Economics, Politics, and the Fight for a Better Future. And I've been reading that, and it's terrific. Also, this is exciting news. Arguing with Zombies has been sold to the Sci-Fi Channel. I understand the makeup is fabulous. It's not real zombies, obviously. But the show is three zombies. It's a talk show format, political talk show, and they argue with Paul. So maybe he'll tell us a little bit about that. You know, I was reading today about the coronavirus around the world, and there's a lot of countries that have done it better than us, but there are a lot of countries that haven't. This pandemic is a global crisis, and President Trump, he punted and went to the governors, but this is usually where the United States has come in. We've been the indispensable nation in the world, and we have completely lost that under Donald Trump. We led in the Ebola crisis. The CDC identified it before anybody else. We were leaders there. We used to be the indispensable nation in the world, but under Donald Trump, we have completely retreated in a terrible way. He screwed up here. Screwed up in our country. There was a New York Times article recently that said that if Trump or the administration had even a week sooner made this a priority, that would have been 35,000 fewer deaths in the United States. He's been a failure on this. We're going to talk to Paul Krugman about the economic consequences of that. Oh, I want to remind everyone to subscribe to the podcast if you're not already subscribed. If you do so, you'll be alerted when we have a new one right away. And you'll get access, of course, to all the previous 53 now episodes that we have. We're now officially in season two. And so I hope you do. Hope you do that. Well, very excited about Paul Krugman. We're going to be talking about the economic consequences of the pandemic and also where we should be going from here. So it's a good one for a change. Paul, I haven't seen you in a while, so thank you. Thank you for doing this.
Sure. Great to be talking to you. Hey, breaks up the monotony of quarantine, right?
Well, thank you for the high praise.
Sorry about that, but yeah.
No, that's okay. So you are a professor emeritus at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton, and you taught before at Stanford, right? And Yale, and MIT, of course, where you got your doctorate. And basically what I'm saying is you're no Larry Kudlow.
No. And I'm now, by the way, my current home base, which is City University of New York Graduate Center, would be upset if I didn't say that I'm now teaching there.
Okay. We may cut that out. But
okay.
No, we won't. Okay. So here's what Larry Kudlow said on February 25th. The U.S. had contained the virus and the economy is holding up nicely.
I always am interested to see what Larry Kudlow has to say, because while some of us are sometimes wrong, all of us are sometimes wrong, Kudlow is always wrong. So if he says something's going to happen, you know it won't. A line about him once somewhere was he turns flamboyant wrongness into a form of performance art. But it's amazing. I mean, that was the mindset in the White House up until some days into March. They didn't want to hear about it. They didn't want anybody else to hear about it. And here we are, 90,000 deaths later and 20 million jobs lost.
Yeah, they kind of blew it. And we'll get into Trump in a minute. I want to talk about zombies.
Yeah.
And have you define them. Been reading your book. And basically, you're saying it's Republicans who are not operating in good faith. Would that be correct?
Well, that's true. But I mean, a zombie idea is an idea that should be dead. It's been killed by evidence repeatedly, but just keeps on shambling along, eating people's brains. Most of the important zombie ideas in American life and American politics are coming from the right. Overwhelmingly, they're coming from the right. In fact, most of our debates, they're not good faith debates between people who have looked at the evidence and reached different conclusions. They are debates between people who have looked at the evidence and people who are peddling zombie ideas. And that's tax cuts paid for themselves. Unemployment insurance makes people lazy. All of these things, which are playing a pretty big role, even in the middle of a pandemic.
Yeah, I want to talk about what we're doing and what we should be doing. I was in the Senate for a while, and my experience with my Republican colleagues. You remember during Simpson-Bowles, like the push for Simpson-Bowles?
Yeah.
I went to a bipartisan meeting on budgets and the economy, and we were still in the Great Recession, and they were talking about cutting Social Security and tightening the belt because deficits meant so much, of course, which is one of their zombie ideas. And at a certain point, and I shouldn't have done this, I just kind of exploded and said, you guys don't care about deficits. You didn't care about deficits during W. And what you want is the economy not to recover so that Obama will lose re-election. And that was the last time I went to that bipartisan meeting.
That was very clear. As soon as there was a Republican in the White House again, they suddenly lost all interest in deficits. The deficit exploded even before the current crisis, and not a peep from all of those deficit hawks that were complaining so much. I mean, what was interesting there was that deficit hawkery wasn't just coming from Republicans. It was coming from centrists. And oddly, the centrists also got quiet once the Republicans started running deficits, which tells you that a lot of centrists aren't actually bipartisan as centrists. They're bipartisan in favor of one party. There was never any reason to take any of that hullabaloo about, oh, these deadly deficits, and we must cut social programs seriously. But it took over, it dominated political discourse for years.
I remember we sequestered stuff. I mean, it was ridiculous what we were doing, and it was true. They just didn't want Obama to succeed. And of course, when they passed this tax cut in 2017, when it was on the floor, I kept going to my Republican colleagues and go, this is going to explode the deficit. And you know that. And they would go, oh, no, it'll create more economic activity. And I'd say, your own Congressional Budget Office says no, first of all. And you know that. And you guys don't care about deficits. You never did. You only care about it when Democrats are president so you can stop them from, accomplishing things. And that won me a lot of friends on that side.
I mean, this idea that tax cuts pay for themselves, that's been tested to destruction again and again and again. We tested it under Reagan. We tested it under W. The opposite to the claim that the Clinton tax hikes would actually increase the deficit. That didn't happen. He actually balanced the budget, the only time we've seen that for a while. Not that that's an important thing, but just, that's the point. We tested it in Kansas.
that was great.
Invested everything on the notion that tax cuts would do wonders for their state economy. They did nothing at all except create a budget crisis.
Yeah, Sam Brownback just bankrupted the state.
And the fact that in 2017, with a whole generation of failure of that idea under our belts, the Republicans just blithely asserted the same thing all over again is quite amazing. But that's the point, that zombies aren't killed by things that would kill something that was truly alive.
Let's talk about where we are now, what we've done so far in response to this crisis, and what we should do going forward versus what Trump and McConnell say want to do.
First of all, state of the economy. If you are interested in the course of a pandemic, listen to the epidemiologists. It's a technical field. You have generations of hard thought, evidence. They can be wrong sometimes, but you know, some amateur coming at it, and that can include somebody who's an expert in something else, but you just don't want to try and second guess them. I don't want to second guess them. And the epidemiologists were terrified well in advance of the actual mass deaths in the United States. They're terrified of the consequences of premature reopening. But the U.S. economy is in the economic equivalent of a medically induced coma, where doctors, you know, deliberately shut down a bunch of brain functions in order to give a chance to heal from acute injury. And what we've done is we've shut down a good part of the economy, shut down restaurants and hotels and travel and a lot of retail and a bunch of other stuff, things that you can live without for a while and are high contact things that will spread the virus. And so this, although the economy has shrunk and a lot of people are not working, those are actually good things. Those are desirable things. The problem is that there are also things that people live on. There are people depend upon the wages, the income. Small businesses depend upon their business. I hate it when people keep on talking about stimulus. We're not trying to stimulate the economy right now. In fact, we want to keep a lid on it for a while longer. What we need to do is we need to make this tolerable. We need to make it possible for people to put food on the table and pay their rent.
Essentially, provide life support for folks.
That's right. Exactly. It's like providing life support for somebody in an induced coma. And the it's disaster relief, not stimulus. This is like a 100 Katrinas have hit the nation as a whole.
And other countries do this, right?
We're not doing an entirely terrible job at this. There's so much bad stuff, and there's so much stuff that's mishandled that I think we're not giving enough credit to the pieces that are being done right, of which the most important is a big expansion of unemployment benefits. The CARES Act, by the way, I would love to reach a point where we stop giving cute names to legislation. But anyway, the CARES Act, which was passed at
somebody
the end of March,
bent over backward to make that the CARE Act.
Yes, I know. And but in any case, the most important component of that is that it expanded the eligibility for unemployment benefits and the duration of unemployment benefits, and increased everybody who's laid off because of COVID gets an extra $600 a week.
For how long?
This thing all expires on July 31st.
Yeah.
If we don't extend it, that's likely to be a moment of crisis. But right now, what's happening is last month, it looks like the unemployment benefits replaced about half of the wages that were lost because of the shutdown. And that was lower than it should have been because we're running this thing through state unemployment offices, which were hugely overstressed, weren't ready to handle this, especially in states that have deliberately made unemployment insurance hard to get. But that's been growing steadily. So we can actually see at this point, we're probably replacing 70-80% of wages lost because of the shutdown. That was included at the insistence of House Democrats. Republicans hated that piece.
Of course.
But that's the reason that we don't have really mass suffering, at least so far, is largely because of that piece. On the other hand, we're supposed to be helping small businesses, and that was disastrously designed and implemented. It's been screw up.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break right now. We'll be right back with Paul Krugman.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
Let me ask you about state and local governments, because going forward, we're talking about McConnell is telling the states to go bankrupt.
Yes.
Which they can they legally? Can a
state? No, they can't.
Okay. I didn't think so.
You know, people were written to me saying, oh, states have gone bankrupt. Mississippi went bankrupt in the 1830s or something. That's been illegal since, I think, 1937. States cannot, in fact, declare bankruptcy. I think McConnell is, if it hasn't hit him already, it will soon. It's not just, you know, blue states with their generous social programs. It's in some ways, actually, it's looking as if places like New York and New Jersey, which have, and California, which have income taxes, are going to hold up better than states that rely entirely on sales tax, like Florida and Texas. So this is going to be a crisis all across the states.
They're laying off people, right? Public
employees.
Yeah,
we've lost a million jobs in state and local government just in the month of April. And when we say jobs in state and local government, think school teachers, which is about half of them, firefighters, police officers. You know, we're not talking about bureaucrats doing nothing that you care about. We're talking about people who educate our kids, who put out fires, and who protect us. And it's shocking that we lost any jobs in that sector. Though that should be expanding to deal with the crisis. But it's going to get much, much worse if we don't get some aid out to the state and local governments.
Obviously, we're paying the price. Everybody in this country is paying the price for the 2 months that went by while Donald Trump wanted to keep the stock market up. Is that what he wanted?
What the reporting is, yeah, that he was, he didn't want to, or Jared Kushner told him, and he agreed that we shouldn't order any extra medical supplies. We shouldn't talk about any kind of contact limitations because that would spook the stock market.
So remember Reagan said the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government, I'm here to help. Well, now the 8 most terrifying words are, I'm Jared Kushner, and I'm here to help.
Yes, I can. It is amazing. He's got the reverse Midas touch. Everything he touches turns to words I can't use on air.
Shit.
Yeah, all right. Okay, yeah. And
people don't know this. I know Paul, and he has a really bad potty mouth.
Oh, right, yeah.
I'm sorry, that's not true.
Not enough to be interesting. But anyway, but this is a guy who really has never done anything right. Other countries are actually reopening because, you know, South Korea had its first case the same day that we did, but they responded quickly with a partial lockdown, a massive ramp up of testing capacity. And the other day, South Korea had there was one guy who was infected who went to nightclubs. And so they had a second outbreak of a couple of hundred people. They flooded the zone. They tested something like 10,000 people, found a bunch of cases, isolated the people, and they brought it under control without having to. They had to shut the nightclubs for a while again.
Probably a good idea.
But they're not having to shut their economy. So we could be there. You know, we're a sophisticated, advanced country, lots of capacity to do stuff. But instead, we ignored it. Once there's a lot of people infected, then you need massive testing capacity to do that kind of thing. And we haven't gotten there. So,
and we have no national plan. You've made the point that, you know, after Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt didn't ask the states to address that.
They moved in immediately to establish national control over key strategic resources, because strategic production, because that's what you do when you have an emergency, instead of a free-for-all in which states are competing with each other. But having a national plan would mean taking responsibility. And so if there's one thing the guy in the White House doesn't do is he himself says that I take no responsibility for anything. So we have not handled this at all with the seriousness and the constant desire to just sort of wish it away. Obviously, it means that lots more people have died and probably lots and lots and lots more people will die because of this. And it also means that the economy is going to, you know, even if there's an attempt to open, it's probably going to fail. We don't know this for sure, but the odds are that we'll see an uptick in infections and we'll be in economic limbo for a much longer time than we would have been if we'd taken this seriously from the beginning.
And again, that's what epidemiologists say.
That's right. Well, they don't talk about the economic consequences, but they're absolutely terrified of the results of premature opening.
Obviously, you're right. I mean, and so many people have said this, we should be testing and contact tracing. That's in the House bill. We have to do that. But this president is, he I think you wrote somewhere that he just will not ever admit that he made a mistake. It's not that he just screwed up those first 2 months. He just screws up every day.
Right. And he refuses to admit, even implicitly admit. I mean, an actual decent leader would say, okay, I was wrong about something, but we're going to fix that. Trump, now, the truth is, he previous Bush never did that either. But at least the Bush administration would slink away, you know, what they would abandon failed policies eventually and pretend they never happened. But Trump actually just doubled down on the mistake. So had this, you know, disastrous, I don't know where this came from, this disastrous recommendation that everybody take hydrochloroquine, which doesn't help COVID and will kill you other ways. He just says, oh, well, I'm taking it now, which doesn't actually mean that he really is. It probably means he just says that, but he won't admit that he was wrong about something. I mean, that was too much even for Fox News hosts. I like the one about injecting yourself with Lysol.
Even that one, he didn't go like, okay, I had a brain freeze and that was ridiculous. But no, he said I was being sarcastic and it's on tape. He just never admits a mistake because of that he keeps making them. I want you to explain something to me and to folks, which is the Fed buying assets, because we hear that all the time. And the Fed stepped up and bought unprecedented amount of money in, right?
Yeah.
So please explain for us what that means, the Fed buying assets.
Literally what the Fed is doing is in fact buying them. It goes to a bank, private bank, and says, well, we want to buy $1 billion of U.S. government treasuries, and we will pay for them by crediting your account at the Fed. The bank has an account at the Fed with $1 billion. That account didn't come from any place. The Fed just waved its digital wand over it, and there it was.
So the purpose of this, if I'm right, is to provide liquidity. Is that right?
Yeah, it is to make sure that money is flowing, that people aren't all trying to hoard cash. One way to say it, look, if everybody tries to hoard more cash and not spend the money on something, then the trouble is, you know, your spending is my income, my spending is your income. So if everybody tries to hoard cash, what we have is a recession. And what the Fed is doing is going out there and buying stuff. And it's only allowed to buy assets. It can't just go out and buy groceries to keep the money flowing so that the economy doesn't crash.
So let me give an example, because I want to try to wrap my head around this. Let's say a corporation needs some money to keep going, right? Can the Fed essentially give them a loan, and maybe not directly, but through a bank or something like that? Is that what's happening?
Yeah, roughly speaking.
That's good enough.
It's good enough. I mean, put it that way. Yeah. To put it this way, the Fed can't lend to a corporation, but it can lend to the corporate sector, basically, is the way to put it. So it can put money in places that ends up being used to lend money to corporations.
Is that called a credit market?
If you strip it down to its essence, yes. Right now, the Fed is lending money to corporations. It's not favoring any particular corporation. That would be a violation of the rules. But I see.
But corporations can go and get a loan from the money that the Fed put in these accounts of banks.
Yes. Close enough.
Okay. Yeah. Close enough.
Yeah.
That's what I thought it was.
Keeping the money flowing by making sure that money doesn't pile up uselessly in banks, but instead gets lent out to businesses.
Okay. And can you lend also to like municipalities?
Yes, they can. And and that's one of the things that they are doing a little bit of now. Now, municipalities themselves have limits on, you know, they can't borrow very much because of balanced budget rules, but there's enough wiggle room in there that's really important. And yes, the Fed is out there buying some munis and keeping the money flowing to cities.
Great. How about for states?
And states.
I want to tell you a story. I'll try to make this short. when we were having the debate on the ACA, part of what we were doing was making trims in Medicare Advantage, which didn't suffer from this at all, and extending the life of Medicare. And I had a Republican senator come up to me and say, well, that's not real money. It's just treasuries. And I said, treasuries are like real money. They're
right.
I said, let me ask you something. Do you have treasuries in your portfolio? And this is what he said. Well, your portfolio is probably bigger than mine. Okay, well, nevertheless, let me tell you, my kids went to college. I laddered these treasuries, and that paid for their college education. Do you have any? He goes, they're not money. I go, well, let me ask you this. What would you do with the extra funds that are coming in? Would you get a warehouse and have freezers there and put steaks in there? Or what? Yeah. What are you talking about? And he goes, they're not money. I go, well, yeah, they are. They're, in fact, the safest money there is. There's the safest thing. They're U.S. Treasury. They're not money. Okay, yeah, what would you put in there? And then this is what he finally said after I pressed him and pressed him. He said, CDs,
yeah.
Certificates of deposit. Now, I could say this guy's name, and I'm tempted, but I won't. But how friggin' stupid and embarrassing is that?
Yeah, I know. And yeah, and if you actually ask me, what is a CD? It's a claim on a bank. What does the bank own? It owns a lot of treasuries. I will name a name. There have been a lot of stupid things said in this crisis. But I think the stupidest thing, stupider than hydrochloroquine, was Lindsey Graham saying that because this virus is China's fault, maybe we should disqualify or default on the treasuries that China owns.
Jesus.
Which, yeah, I mean, right now, U.S. government debt is the safest asset in the world. But if we start saying, well, except we don't repay the debt if we don't like you, that's a way to really destroy the world financial system and the U.S. economy.
Lindsay's kind of gone off the tracks there.
Not my department. I really want to know what happened to him.
I'll tell you. They have something on him. And it's kind of an open secret in Washington. He's a compulsive shoplifter. And they have video of him lifting a gravy boat from Pottery Barn.
Okay. All right.
That's what it is.
I'll let that lie there.
They got him.
Okay.
All right. Let's take a break right now. And we'll be right back with Paul Krugman. His latest book is Arguing with Zombies.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Let's talk about healthcare. Okay, the president, of course, they're going to the Supreme Court to try to declare the ACA unconstitutional. People who are losing their jobs are losing their coverage, or they have to go into COBRA, which is then they have to pay for the full boat on COBRA. They can go into the ACA, right? I was wondering, what do you think of saying they can directly be enrolled immediately in Medicaid?
Well, I would be great. Now, the Medicaid is means tested. Even the expanded Medicaid in states that have expanded it, you have to have lost enough income. But the fact of the matter is, a lot of people are going to be eligible for Medicaid. The estimates I've seen, and these are all, we're everything is happening so fast that everything is provisional. But the estimates are that something like 27 million people are going to lose their employer-based health coverage. Of those, about 21 million will be eligible either for Medicaid, and I think the majority of those are Medicaid, especially, of course, in states that expanded Medicaid under the ACA. And then the rest will be eligible for subsidized insurance policies under the ACA.
You know who touted that the other day? I don't know if you heard this. It was Cornyn.
Yes, Cornyn, who's trying to destroy the ACA, is saying, don't worry, the ACA will take care of you. It's amazing.
He did an advertisement for the ACA.
Well, the good news is that if you lose your employer-provided coverage, which covers about 180 million Americans, then that is a significant life event, which makes you then eligible to sign up for the Affordable Care Act. And as you know, it has a sliding scale of subsidies up to 400% of poverty. So that's an option for poor people.
What a putz.
Yeah. The people who are want to destroy it are meanwhile relying upon it as to sort of catch the falling workers. And you know, if we had single payer, which I would support if I thought it was politically possible.
I've read your writings on this. You would support single payer but keep private insurance, right?
If I could just wave away the politics entirely, I would just go single payer without a private option. Say that basic health, do what the Canadians do. Basic health insurance comes from the government. You can buy for stuff that isn't covered by the government insurance. You can buy additional insurance for it. So for cosmetic surgery or whatever.
70% of Canadians get some supplemental private insurance.
That's right. And that's certainly fine. And in fact, something where you have basically you can buy into a heavily subsidized government insurance program, but you still, if you prefer, can run it through a private insurer. That's a compromise that preserves most of the advantages. That's something that looks like it might be politically doable in the future.
And the politics on this is really important, because in 2018, the reason we flipped 40 seats is because when they were going to repeal and replace the ACA, what they came up with was horrible. And people understood what was in the ACA finally.
Yeah.
And they saw that these didn't necessarily protect people with pre-existing conditions. We flipped 40 seats, which when you flip seats, it means those were Republican seats. I was very worried that we would go into the general election. And, you know, I love Bernie, but we would be the only country in the world that has universal health care. All the developed countries have it. They all have private insurance.
Yeah. Yeah. Sanders' proposal was something that would have been way to the left of Canada and would have been to the left of France, really. And that didn't seem realistic.
Well, I think we would have lost the House, because in those 40 districts, those were flipped. So those were at best purple. All these people who get their insurance through their employer and like it, politically, I think it would have been very, very dangerous.
Even if you think that government coverage would be better than the private coverage, convincing people of that, saying, okay, I'm going to upend everything. I'm going to take this insurance that you have that you think is pretty good and replace it with something totally different. And trust me, it'll be better. That's just too heavy a lift. Now, in fact, I don't even think we're going to get the Medicare with the choice of private insurance. Not yet. I think what we're likely to get, if all goes well under a Biden administration, is ACA 2.0, with no limit on how high your income is to get the subsidies, with the subsidies more generous, with Medicaid eligibility expanded, which will get us pretty close to universal coverage.
Well, you know, Medicaid expansion, unbelievably popular.
Yes, exactly.
In 2017, when they were proposing their health care plan to replace the ACA, one of the things they would have eliminated is Medicaid expansion. And I went around the red areas of Minnesota, and they were crazed I had town hall meetings in hospitals, and people were very scared because Medicaid expansion had done tremendous amount for rural hospitals. And very often now the hospitals were the largest employer in the county. And if you look at the three last states to approve Medicaid expansion by referendum, it's Idaho, Nebraska, and Utah.
Yep.
So this is extremely popular, Medicaid expansion.
Yeah, we tend on healthcare to do hodgepodge solutions, Rube Goldberg devices. And if you're a true blue, in fact, progressive, you kind of want a clean, comprehensive system. But unfortunately, there's a lot of history in there. And so you sort of start from where you are and you improve on it. I have quite high hopes that we'll do that, and we'll get another 15 million people insured, and we'll improve the quality of the insurance for everybody else. And that's huge progress. I mean, the ACA has saved lots of lives and saved lots of people. You know, I'm high socioeconomic status, and most of the people I know are, but I know people who would not have been insured without the ACA, and then got breast cancer or something, and it has been literally a lifesaver for them.
Absolutely. And just one last thing on this is that every other country has, a developed country has universal health care, and they do it for about half or 60% of the costs that we do it, and they have just as good outcomes, but they all, every one of them, has private insurance.
Yeah.
We also have to get pharmaceutical prices under control. The rest of the world pays about 30% of what we do.
Yeah. And a lot of other things too, but pharmaceuticals, medical equipment, the provider side, there's too much profiteering going on. But all that, but you know, work on that. But the most important thing, especially right now, think about what the current situation would be like without the ACA.
Okay, so tell me what we should do now and in the future. Tell us, oh wise one, let's say we win. Let's say we win.
So agenda items. I mean, you know, first of all, get this pandemic under control, because I very much doubt that.
I'm going to write that down. Hang on, otherwise I'll forget it. Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, the end of the pandemic.
So that's going to be, I very much doubt that we'll actually have, given current management, that things will in fact be under control by late January. Two things that a Biden administration with a Democratic House and Senate, nothing happens unless you have all of that. So things they should be doing. We want to enhance the safety net. Investing in children, I would hope, would be a big theme here. That it doesn't cost a lot of money. Children are cheap and pays huge dividends socially and in the long term. Infrastructure.
Remember Trump's, the $1 trillion infrastructure pack. Did you hear him the other day? It was like a couple weeks ago, where he said there was no infrastructure in the stimulus package.
Oh boy! I mean, I remember there were lots of signs saying this paid for by the ARRA.
Yeah, and it should have said paid for by the stimulus package, because no one knew what the ARRA was.
Yeah,
that's we're bad at messaging in some ways.
Yeah, definitely.
Remember, you know the phone number for the exchanges, for the federal exchange, was not like 1-800-GET-CARE.
Yeah.
It was like random. It was like a random number. If you sell mattresses, you know not to do that.
Terrible messaging. But the infrastructure spending in the stimulus was only a few hundred billion, and we need vastly more than that.
And that's because Susan Collins held out for more tax cuts and less infrastructure.
I don't understand even now why we couldn't have just used reconciliation. I mean, if Republicans can pass a $2 trillion tax cut with only 53 senators, why couldn't you have passed a stimulus bill in the middle of the Great Recession without 60 senators? It's never been explained to me why that was unthinkable then, when Republicans had no hesitation at all about doing that once they had a president. White House officials under Obama were too cautious. And they, among other things, they misdiagnosed. They kept on saying it has to be timely, it has to come in fast. It was fairly obvious even then that we were likely to actually have a sustained period of depressed economic conditions. And now we're in a situation where even if we manage to get back to something like full employment, we desperately need infrastructure. The federal government can borrow at ridiculously low interest rates. So we should just have a big infrastructure push and deficit finance it. So a trillion isn't remotely enough. Actually, we should be at least 2 trillion, maybe more. So that should be a major push point. And wrap up stuff together. The Green New Deal. I'm a Green New Deal enthusiast. And people ask, well, what does the Green New Deal mean? And I said, I'm not sure. And that's good. You know, we want it to be a grab bag of things that are good for the environment, but also good for employment and good for infrastructure, and wrap it all up, do things related and not. So basically, spend on making America a better place would be the quick summary of what Biden should do if he gets the chance.
Yeah, on climate, of course. There was a time where there were some Republicans who acknowledged that we had a problem there, but that ended when the Koch brothers started pouring their money in, and you got the word that you're going to be primaried if you believed in climate change.
Yeah, climate change was a dress rehearsal for the pandemic. I mean, the denial, experts are the enemy, and it's all a vast conspiracy. And so, yeah, we're going to have to save civilization in the teeth of constant political opposition. You know, Obama was making some headway despite that, even with Republican Congress through executive orders. So I would hope that if we actually have a Democratic Congress, that a Biden administration could do quite a lot. I mean, that's... they better, because otherwise, without U.S. leadership, it doesn't happen globally. And without action, this is, you know, we really are talking about existential civilization threatening risks here.
Well, speaking of action and reconciliation, I think they have to get rid of the filibuster. We are so tribal now. You know, we're not going to have 60, that's for sure. A lot of people understand that if we're going to actually do things, that's what we're going to have to do.
Yeah, I mean, and of course, in some stuff, again, it turns out that fiscal measures that don't increase the deficit outside a 10-year window, you can already bypass the filibuster. But if it turns out you can't do everything you need to do, then there are things that are a lot more important than legislative rules that are not even in the Constitution. They're just tradition.
Well, it was a tradition in order to get bipartisan agreement on stuff.
Yeah.
And that doesn't exist anymore because these zombies are zombies.
Yeah. The zombie ideas have completely taken over one wing. I mean, if I want to get really pessimistic, I just say, you know, with half the U.S. political system controlled by a fundamentally anti-democratic, anti-rationality movement, you know, it's a lot better if it's slightly less than half the political system controlled by that, because that means you can actually do something, but it's still very, very hard to do anything. And we face gigantic problems. Climate change, top of the list, but you have to do lots of other stuff in order to have the political capital to deal with that. So this is not the Republican Party of Everett Dirksen, right, where you could expect some kind of reasonable compromise.
You know, you write in Arguing with Zombies about a number of subjects. You know, income and wealth inequality. We're back in, you know, the 1880s.
In some ways, Thomas Piketty, he talks about the Belle Époque in pre-World War I France, where a lot of it was inherited wealth. It was sort of dynastic, and we're headed into that kind of society. And immense inequality. You can see, I mean, the Times had a fantastic analysis during the pandemic. About 5% of New York City's population decamped. By the way, including me, I have to admit, I'm actually out in Princeton at the moment, and I'm very aware of the privilege involved in being able to do that. And of course, where did people decamp from? They decamped from the Upper East Side and the Upper West Side. And so, literally, inequality is a question of life and death. And it's insane. The thing is, we know a lot about how to do it. I always use the example of Denmark, which is a little more unequal than it was 20 years ago, but not remotely like America. And how do they do it? And the answer is both ends. They have much more equal wages, much more equal compensation up front. And that has to do a lot with the fact that 60% of Danish workers are union members. They've created an environment which is friendly towards labor organizing. Then they have a much more extensive welfare state. Their taxes are not all that much more progressive than ours, but they're higher and they pay for, you know, childcare, healthcare, income support for the poor. And the point is that everything that we worry about, people talk about, well, you know, what about the robots? What about globalization? The Danes face the same technology, the same global marketplace that we do, and yet they manage to have a decent middle-class society, and we don't.
And they've opened, haven't they? They got a handle on this and have opened more earlier and,
yeah,
and more widely than we have.
They were more restrictive. You know, Sweden never really did impose the restrictions, but Sweden has a much higher death rate than its neighbors. But Denmark closed down for a bit. It still has many restrictions in place, but they've opened more than we have. And of course, they haven't suffered anything like the mass unemployment we have because they subsidize employers to keep people on payroll. There's something to be said for enhanced unemployment benefits also, because it's not clear that every employer is going to go back to where it was before. I don't know. I gather that some people are still trying to book cruise ship for 2021, which I find hard to understand. But anyway,
it's a lot of fun on the cruise. The food is great. You can eat as much as you want. They have entertainment.
Yeah, but it's still.
You go to different ports, you know.
No, I understand the appeal of it, or I understand that it does appeal to some people, not my kind of thing, but no, but still, the point, anyway, let's get diverged.
I'll bet you could get paid for speaking on a cruise.
That has, actually, I only got an offer to do that once.
And you turned it down, and you turned it down.
I couldn't do it, but there is actually a cruise that is specifically devoted to denouncing me every year. It's a libertarian cruise.
Wait, is it advertised that way,
yeah,
or is it just a libertarian cruise?
It's the Contra Krugman cruise. Seriously,
wow.
Look it up. So
that is, what an honor.
Yeah, it is. That's a huge, it's incredibly flattering.
That's great.
But yes, the point is that it's like a lot of stuff. We make universal health care seem incredibly hard to do, but in fact, everybody else manages to do it. We make tackling inequality seem incredibly hard to do, but in terms of the economics, we pretty much do know how to do it because other countries have done it, and we ourselves did it. America in 1929 was a very unequal place. America in 1950 was a middle-class society, and that didn't happen by accident. That happened because FDR and progressives generally made it happen. So it's all about the politics.
You know, Paul Wellstone used to say, we all do better when we all do better. And, you know, if a bridge collapses, a Mercedes falls as fast as a Hyundai. And we need infrastructure. Income inequality, wealth inequality is toxic. It really is hurting our society. I asked some folks online to send in some questions for you, and I got a couple, okay? Kenneth Folk asked me to ask about universal basic income.
Okay. Now, that's a genuine debate. It's not a zombie thing. It's
yeah, that's a legitimate.
It's a legitimate, and it's an interesting one. And the way I look at it is that, believe it or not, the pandemic is showing us the problems with that idea. UBI would mean that everybody gets a check sort of unconditionally from the government every month, which sounds great. But what's happening right now is that about 1 in 5 U.S. workers has lost her or his income. But we're making up most of that through expanded unemployment benefits. But that's costing, it's probably going to cost $80 billion this month. if you were to try and supply people with that much income, everybody, not just the people who've lost their jobs because of COVID, it would cost something like $5 trillion over the course of a year. And that's not going to happen. That's a quarter of GDP. And anything that's even remotely conceivable would be way inadequate. It wouldn't come close to replacing the income that people are losing. So UBI is not actually the solution to something like this. We need something that's much more targeted, like unemployment benefits. And so I think that what we're getting here is we're getting a demonstration that a strong safety net is essential, but we're not, you can't provide a sufficiently strong safety net if you make it unconditional.
Okay, well, you answered Kenneth's question. Here's another one, okay? Considering current course of action, where is our economy going to be comparing to the world economy? Is there a chance of partial global recovery?
Oh, yeah. I mean, partial, easy. Even the United States will probably have partial recovery, although we may backslide once the second wave of infection hits. It's all about the epidemiology. You know, if we could magically make the virus disappear, I think the U.S. economy could rebound really fast. This is not like the last crisis where we had this overhang of bad debt and overbuilt housing and all of that that held us back. But the trouble is that we are nowhere close to being able to resume normal life without creating an explosion of COVID-19 cases. So,
But Trump is determined to do that, try to do that. And to me, I think you wrote in some column, he just won't admit any mistakes, so he keeps making the same ones.
Yeah, that's right. So it's always the same. And so, yeah, he's now behaving exactly the same way he did in those crucial 2 months before he was willing to admit that we actually had a problem. And the result will be the same, that we'll probably be forced into a second lockdown. We don't know that for sure, but the epidemiologists say they don't know for sure, but they think it's highly likely as we relax too soon now. Earlier in this conversation, we talked about how these unemployment benefits, which are doing enormous good right now, will expire on July 31st. And the second lockdown, if it becomes necessary, is going to happen after that. And, you know, Lindsey Graham has already said, we'll extend those unemployment benefits over my dead body.
Shoplifting.
Actually, over other people's dead bodies. So that's a great concern I have.
Is there a chance of partial global recovery? You said yes. Yes, yes, yes.
No, clearly. I mean, China is having some recovery now. And that's, you know, they're, depending on how you measure it, they're either second to us or bigger than us as an economy. A fair bit of Europe is starting a limited recovery. Partial global recovery is not a hard thing to envision. The idea that, yeah, we might have starting in the summer, we start to see the world economy growing and even the U.S. economy growing again, that doesn't mean we won't still have mass unemployment a year from now. If the question is, can we have partial recovery? Yes. Can we have full recovery? It's hard to see how that happens for a long time.
Well, that's too bad. Paul, thanks for joining us. You know, you're a hero of mine. When I wrote the book, Lies and Lying Liars, Who Tell Them a Fair and Balanced Look at the Right, I did that. I was a fellow at the Shorenstein Center, the Kennedy School at Harvard, and I put together these students to help me research the book as a study group. I put out a thing and I got all these applications for it. And so I had Ben Wickler, who is now chairman of the Democratic Party in Wisconsin, an important job.
Yeah.
Ben Wickler, I interviewed him. And the first thing he said, well, I write for The Onion, because he's from Madison, Wisconsin.
Okay.
So I write for The Onion and I'm a big, big fan of Paul Krugman.
All right.
And I went, okay, you're in.
Okay, that's good. Boy, you know, when I took this job writing for the Times, I had no idea. I actually thought I'd be spending my time discussing serious arguments about policy. And instead, I'm busy talking about lies and the lying liars all the time.
And now they're all zombies. Paul, thank you for joining us. Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.